Welcome to Sage Advice, the podcast where the future of higher education is not just discussed, it's crafted. Every episode, we dive deep into the transformative world of learning, bringing you conversations with the pioneers and policymakers who are reshaping education today. Joining you from the innovative halls of Western Governors University, I'm your host, Chris Bunnell. Welcome back to the WGU Sage Advice Podcast for the last episode of Season 2. This season, we spoke to leaders about evolving workforce landscape. My co-host and executive producer, Emma Solomon, is joining me for this special edition of the podcast, where we'll reflect on our conversations from the past month.
That's right, Chris. We are going to be revisiting some of our favorite moments from this season and some key takeaways for our listeners. But before we get started, Chris, I'm wondering, what are your high-level takeaways about the evolving nature of the workforce and higher education landscape?
Thanks, Emma. You know, I think the biggest takeaways are that we're in the proverbial Wild West landscape of both evolving workforce and education. I think there are all kinds of options that exist, innovative ideas, transformational opportunities. And now the challenge is who's going to be strong enough, have the courage of their convictions to embrace change and flip the dynamic so that the whole country becomes student-focused. What about you, Emma?
I think one of the things that impressed upon me a lot was not only how much is changing in the world, like as we all move into this online space, but also how much is staying the same and how some of these like skills that maybe we take for granted are really foundational to so many different careers. I know we're going to get into this later, but Mitsu, the leader of our school of business, calls them our power skills, a lot of people call them soft skills, and how that really dovetails today with like the advent of AI and how those really can complement each other very well. So let's get into it.
Let's go. Lots to talk about. Let's look first at some of the great moments this season, starting with WGU's Vice Provost of Workforce Intelligence and Credential Integrity, Sarah DeMarc. Her department is future-focused and analyzes anticipated workforce needs. They ensure our students gain the most cutting-edge, market-relevant skills in their industry.
And the other thing that's super fascinating, too, about WGU is that because of the way we design and develop programs, we're actually thinking about it at the program level. How do we build a program experience that ensures that students are getting all of the critical skills along that pathway? I think in more traditional universities, instructors are sort of teaching what's interesting to them in a way that's interesting to them. And so at least my experience was, it feels more like a collection of disparate programs as opposed to like a collective, cohesive program that actually feels like a whole thing as opposed to a bunch of parts. And so I think that's kind of another interesting piece to how we design and develop programs.
Emma, does that resonate with you?
It does. When I was going through my journey, my higher education journey, I was required to do things like PE, which I think I satisfied with a dance class, and a science, which I went through a course on bees and beekeeping, which was not at all relevant to my international relations degree. How about you, Chris?
I went into higher education a bit unfocused. I had two pathways, which kind of seems to be the story of my career. One was to be a physical education teacher and coach, and the second was to be an attorney. So what I found was trying to bounce back and forth until I set my path directly is that there was not a lot of overlap. And frankly, could have been one of those students who required extra years, if not for taking an overload of credits, because there was no connective tissue between the courses. I had chewed up a lot of the gen ed courses in my first year and a half. And so just flip-flopping back and forth between interests made it real difficult at the end to find the path that got me out the door.
I think that cohesiveness of our degree programs is especially pertinent to our adult learners who really need to be focused on what they need to know, especially in our programs like accounting or nursing or teaching. Obviously, like, there needs to be options for everyone. All higher education options are valid. But I think especially for a busy adult learner, it's really valuable to have something that feels like it's building on each course, that it's all aligned with what you need to know for the workplace.
What we're looking for, again, with that workforce alignment piece is there's certain skills that we see over and over and over that are coming up, like communication skills, right? Like, that's an obvious one. And that's going to be across any career path that you're going to look into. And also things like even data analytics or being able to like understand data, like that's becoming more and more of a critical skill that will show up in any field that you pursue. Understanding how to work with diverse populations, right, is also another critical skill. Collaboration, also critical skill. So how do we start to create like gen ed programs in particular, because those go across all programs, that are really hitting those power skills, transferable skills, whatever you want to call them. But how do we build that into the curriculum? Because at a level that it goes across all of our programs, because it is important for all of our programs.
I think you're exactly right, Emma. And when we differentiate where we are meeting and serving students, I think the differences are fairly substantial in that they need an efficient pathway to their next opportunity for growth and advancement. I was fortunate to know that ultimately, especially if it was headed into law, that I'd have 3 additional years of learning. And so, you know, a little more carefree at 18, 19 years old than mid-career looking to find that pathway.
Well, should we get into some of our episodes with the leaders of WGU's schools?
I think we should. Paul Bingham was an FBI agent for nearly 25 years before joining WGU to lead the College of Information Technology. He sat down with me to discuss the future of cybersecurity and how companies and states can arm themselves against cybercrime.
Majority of our students are enrolled in cybersecurity. And of course, that's the discipline that I kind of grew up in during my time at the FBI. All of us, whether we have a job in cybersecurity or not, have some responsibility for our own personal cybersecurity, as well as sort of the whole national infrastructure that's security related. And so in terms of skills, I think maybe we'll get there in the conversation, but all of us have a responsibility to do certain things that will help protect us, help protect our companies, and help protect, like I said, the larger infrastructure. Those who have a job that has security or other IT skills in it, the underlying foundational principles of almost all the disciplines in IT have not changed dramatically. We are still in the era of binary code. Now, what's over the horizon and what do you hear people talking about is quantum computing, and that's going to change things dramatically. The timeline for that is flip a coin and talk to 10 different people and you'll get 15 different answers. The big challenges with quantum computing, of course, are managing the heat issue that all this computing generates, as well as the stability of the actual machines. Anyway, before I get off on that tangent, we're still in the era of binary code. Ones and zeros rule everything that we do. So starting at that level, having a good solid understanding of those principles still helps us, because what has changed dramatically is the application of all of these underlying and foundational principles. Even AI, AI is not necessarily new technology. It's just really awesome use of the foundational technology that we've been using for programming and for machine learning and concepts like that. Again, until the dawn of widespread quantum computing, that's going to change everything. So very important. And we focus in our programs on those foundational skills. And then we do introduce, well, now what's the application of those skills? And build upon those by trying to introduce, and hence my comments a little earlier about an 18-month or 24-month refresh rate on our curriculum, because the application of those foundations changes dramatically. An example of this that most of us are familiar with is passwords.
Paul Bingham there. What I enjoyed most was hearing about Paul's FBI experience and how he applies that experience to course development at WGU.
FBI agents have a mandatory retirement age when they turn 57. And so you don't see FBI agents older than 57 years old. By statute, we are politely told that it's time to retire. I am actually 57 now. I'll reveal that. But in general, most of us tend to leave between the ages of 50 and 57, and that's exactly what I did. I always thought I would either teach or go into some kind of a consulting capacity, and WGU just really hooked me. My time with the FBI was strongly motivated by a desire to protect the innocent and defend those who have been victimized by crime, protect our country from terrorism. And WGU had a mission that rang true to me. I call it the nobility of the mission in WGU of improving lives by creating pathways to opportunity. And so it just fit. And the education piece really grabbed me as well.
Paul has had a remarkable career trajectory. To think that we have a former FBI agent leading the next generation of cybersecurity experts helps me sleep better.
We have had some pretty incredible people on the podcast this season.
Let's talk about another leader at WGU. Mitzi Frazier leads WGU's business school. We discussed how she's addressing competency-based education for the business world's ever-evolving needs. And we spoke about how some of the foundational elements of business, like communications, are called power skills here at WGU.
Yeah, so I might coin the term power skills, if I may. And so soft skills is used pretty regularly, but we are thinking about power skills in the College of Business, including self-awareness, self-management, interpersonal communication, social awareness, and how do we infuse those power skills into our content? And I think that starts in a couple different ways. One, over the last few years, many of our faculty members have received training themselves on power skills. So not just let's ensure that our students are equipped with these power skills, but ensure that the faculty who are engaging with them and modeling by example the use of these skills are also in play. So these trained employees are interacting with students. They're calling on those power skills to lead by example. And then we're infusing them across our curriculum as well. And the goal is to ensure that the learner journey, both academic, career, and life focused, has a tether to those various power skills. Even more learners to move into the workforce prepared. We spend a lot of time focused on talking with employers and understanding the skills and the tangible needs that these employers need from their employees as they hit the desks on their first day or as they're solving problems. And that conversation is what's informing the decision to create our next product. And so as we're building programs, it's not by chance. It's not by simply looking at a list of business degrees that a school should have, but rather it's a future focused lens that is thinking about what do we need today? But from an employer standpoint, what are the things that keep you up at night that we can solve for you? And so as we were thinking about supply chain, as we were thinking about finance, both of those degrees had a lens of what employers are saying they need most, what the industry and trends in the market are saying have room for new jobs. And then we applied those learnings as we created the programs. In addition to that, a graduate degree in HR, knowing that from an HR perspective and the diverse problems that are being solved in that area is such that we knew that we could take our undergraduate in HR and we could create a great bridge to even more skills, upskilling that individual to be even more powerful in their place of employment. So in a tangible way, I've seen WGU's mission fulfilled in that I think WGU graduates reported an average increase of just over $29,000 within 4 years of graduation. That's using Harris Poll from the 2022 survey. But it is clear that as students engage our programs, they are seeing a return on that investment very quickly. And employers are seeing that return as well, as they are very pleased about the quality of employee that they're hiring as a WGU graduate.
Mitsu is one example of WGU leadership who started in a student-facing role before leading their college. She embodies our competency-based education values of learning by experience.
Yes. And another senior vice president here at WGU, Stacey Ludwig Johnson, began her time at the university working directly with students, which undoubtedly makes her a stronger leader in the School of Education.
If you're already in a low-income situation and maybe you have one or two kids that you're also supporting, the fact that you lose your job and your insurance, which that's actually more important oftentimes is losing insurance, student teaching, which is like crucial to being a great teacher, is also a barrier to entry for the exact profile of teachers that we need in our classrooms.
In our conversation, I asked her what policies she hoped a state legislature might consider to help mitigate the teacher shortage. One of those recommendations was to support prospective educators during their demonstration teaching.
There's an oft-cited statistic that most Americans couldn't cover a $400 emergency expense with cash. Asking someone to take 2 months without pay is unimaginable, particularly for adults with families to provide for.
I think the other thing to add to that, so there's the policy around ensuring that parapros can be paid while they're working on their initial license. The other thing is greater flexibility in the states for the transportability of teacher licenses. I mean, more and more, we are a population of adults that move around the country. We need the ability for teachers to be able to take their experience and their license across state lines. And that is another particularly challenging aspect of many of the rules, and again, a barrier for teachers. So I think that would be another opportunity, would be to allow for greater flexibility there, because though we would love for our teachers to remain in their local community, there are times when they need to be able to relocate. And it's really unfortunate when we make the practice for a teacher to move from one state to another, make that so cumbersome that we have these amazing experienced teachers that are relocating. And sometimes that hurdle is just more than they're able to overcome, or it's too complex, and we lose them to other jobs and the economy. So I think that's another area that it's within our reach and our ability to actually solve for.
No question, Emma. And in fact, it has been so great to see in this current legislative session, states at least beginning to have that conversation. We don't have a fix yet, but people like Stacey are contributing to the conversation. In the conversation, Stacey also discussed how we need more teachers of historically underrepresented ethnicities in our schools. Innumerable studies show that outcomes improve when diverse educators teach students. Stacey explained how the advent of teacher apprenticeships may help recruit a more diverse teacher workforce.
This is an interesting disruption in our space, is that it is tailored so well to sort of parallel the Grow Your Own initiatives with local districts and states. And so with apprentices, usually the districts are reaching down into the community and pulling community leaders into the schools. They get them into a paraprofessional or teacher assistant, whatever you may call it, space. And then the apprenticeship program can come in while they're moving from a parapro to get their second 2 years. So if they're doing a four-year program to be a licensed teacher, they get those first 2 years, they move into a parapro position, then the apprenticeship can come in for the last 1 or 2 years where they're paid to be a teacher in the classroom. They're working alongside what we call a mentor teacher who is already a teacher in that building. And then they get fantastic on-the-job training. It's completely job embedded. For me, it connects so well with competency-based education. There's no better performance or assessment measure than actually watching somebody and observing their work as they're demonstrating those competencies. But then at the end of that, what the research is showing is that A, apprenticeships, because they're pulling oftentimes from the local community, certainly recruit a more diverse teacher workforce. It's not uncommon for apprenticeship programs to have 50, 60% or more that are Black, African American, or Hispanic, or Indigenous population enrolled.
And on the topic of teachers, one of our guests this season began her career in the classroom before pivoting to a new industry and was actually named Teacher of the Year. Can you guess who that was, Chris?
KKC, it's Kim Kelly Cortez.
Ding, ding. Kim Kelly Cortez is the Senior Associate Dean and Director of Undergraduate Programs at the Levitt School of Health. We spoke about how WGU is changing nursing education. In our conversation, I asked her what she would share if she were speaking to a legislator concerned about the nursing shortage, and she had two pieces of advice.
It requires clinical placements during the student's learning journey. And it requires educators to actually teach the next generation of nursing. So you kind of heard my story a little bit earlier in the things that I talked about how I was in education and I loved education. And it was so financially devastating to be an educator that I literally could not live my life. And so I went into nursing so that I could have the funds to be able to take care of my family and take care about all the things I needed to do. So here we have bedside nurses. We have nurses that are working at the bedside. So, hey, go ahead and incur a lot more debt and then turn around and take a 20 to 30% pay cut to go into nursing education. And that's what we're asking people to do. And so as a legislature, until you figure out a way to help us level the playing field, until you look for some ways to maybe provide support for that pay disparity between those two things. And I know a lot of times legislatures and others that I've spoken to about this, so, well, why don't we just pay them more? All nurses have to do clinical rotations. These are called direct clinical hours. Every state has a different requirement. They are not universal, although all graduates of a pre-licensure nursing program take the exact same national licensure exam. The states all have different requirements on the type of education provided, the number of direct clinical hours, the number of simulation hours. States and their regulatory agencies have different requirements for these things. So even though we have a national exam, you will have to do different things in each one of those states. All of those states, however, require direct clinical hours. They could be different based on that state. So here we have these hospital partners with a very strained staff, a very tired nursing staff, and a requirement that all students in a nursing program have clinical placement hours, that they are going in and working with these nurses one-on-one at the bedside. They are sitting there doing that, which again slows the nurse down even more because again, they do have to explain that. They have to train them. We don't give any pay parity there either. We do not provide any supplemental funding to those hospital systems. We don't provide any funding to those bedside nurses, those preceptors, those coaches that are taking those students. We don't provide any funding for any of this. You're asking everybody to do it out of the intrinsic nature of goodness. And again, nurses are very intrinsic, but they're also very tired. And so at some point, you really have to look at how can our government officials help us with this? If we're really making nursing a priority, then we need to prioritize our ability to get clinical placements. We need to find some ways to support our hospitals to make it viable to bring the students in, really create these academic partnerships. It can't just be we want to do it. It has to be funding available to support us doing this work, because it is hard work. Can't ask a nurse to have 7 patients, 8 patients, and nursing students. You can't ask them to be working those hours, working those shifts, filling those gaps, and by the way, teach the next generation. We've got to provide some support in both areas to really grow nursing and really help alleviate the shortage. That's the only way it's going to happen.
Then we delve deeply into skills architecture at WGU with Casey Thorne, our senior director. She joined me to discuss the crossroads between academic programming and workforce development and how rich skill descriptors, or RSD, plays a pivotal role.
We started talking to hiring managers. We talked to practitioners in the field and started to unpack what the performance of any of those skills looked like in a specific context. That skill statement, we then took and we tagged it, we aligned it to the keywords that were also representative of that skill statement. We aligned it to job roles and job codes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and that job taxonomy. And collecting all of that information around that central skill statement is what we call a rich skills descriptor. It is a powerful little data package that gives you the contextual application of the skill, as well as other metadata that does 2 really important things. Now we have a skill that is both human readable, meaning we can look at the skill and understand what it means. We can read it. We get what it is in context. And it's also machine readable and machine actionable, so that when we're using those rich skills descriptors and aligning it to curriculum, aligning it to job descriptions, we can let AI and the machines do their thing and help us better find content that aligns to those skills and people who might have the skill set that we're looking for to hire. So that is an RSD. It is the kind of next evolution, I think, of what we need to move towards a more intentional and meaningful skills-based ecosystem.
That was Casey. Our conversation touched on many points around career development and how students can position themselves and their skills for prospective employers. Casey shared some fascinating insights into how WGU alumni, including those who graduated many years ago, can demonstrate that they possess market-relevant skill sets today.
It really truly is those enduring skills or human skills that are 80% of what employers are looking for. How can you translate effective communication skills from one setting to another? And in order to do that effectively, you have to have an understanding of what good communication looks like in different settings. There's different tools, different techniques, different things that are being communicated about. So I would say really getting clear on what those transferable skills are that basically endure over time and can endure across settings. There's also multiple options, I think, now more than ever, really, with the internet and the advancements of technology, even in terms of free open resources to help you upskill in particular areas. So that is certainly something that I would say to take advantage of, be on the lookout for. We're definitely in an age now where you can't just plan on the degree being one and done. It's going to have to be refined and updated over time. And so leverage those free resources. And then, of course, there's also organizations, right, like WGU, I think, that are very helpful in that capacity as well. One of the things that we're trying to accomplish with our programs, and this is just in very early stages right now, is understanding what the skill resiliency is for particular programs so that someone going into those programs is going to know basically what the refresh rate is and what the upkeep on this skill set is going to be. Is this something that they're going to have and be able to just keep refining their human skills, their enduring skills over time? Or is this going to be something they're going to have to learn a new coding language every 6 months, or they're going to have to recertify for something in 2 years? So a little bit more transparency there as well, and helping people actually understand what the refresh rate on those skills might be in order for them to stay current and to stay relevant in the job market.
Another fantastic guest this season was Dr. Lisa Herring, president of Propel, who was recently appointed strategic advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Education under the Biden-Harris administration. She spent her career as a leader in education, and we spoke about how a teacher's influence has a ripple effect well beyond their short years with their students. Let's pick up on that conversation.
In so many ways, right? And imagine, just imagine, if you will, states that we are experiencing teacher strikes, where we're talking about compensation or beyond compensation recognition, or the teacher who feels threatened in the classroom. There's so many layers of issues that it's important and imperative that we look at the experience of the teacher and how what happens in education is not just graduating a student, but quite honestly shapes and impacts the trajectory of the workforce, right? It shapes and impacts the trajectory of voting, like all the things. Like, this is where we learn and are informed about many things that are tied to our life experiences, both professionally and to a degree personally. I don't want to get into a debate there, but there's just so much power in the classroom that we must get that correct. We must, for the sake of our country and our world.
I hope our listeners check out one of my favorite conversations of the season. It's one I had with the leader in disruptive innovation, Michael Horn. Michael is co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute, a public speaker and an author. He joined me to discuss changes in higher education and, more specifically, competency-based learning.
If I'm being totally honest, we need a parallel system of higher education, full stop, to do this correctly. It is not going to happen through the existing institutions. Now, it's not to say some of them can't set up programs like a Southern New Hampshire University did that follow a competency-based model, but it cannot be done within campuses that have been exquisitely built around credit hours as the unit of measurement for everything from how they schedule to semesters to teaching loads to student payments to the financial aid system from the federal government that is really built on a measure of time, not learning, to frankly the fact that if we really want to do this right, we would have external third-party assessments that showed mastery. So right now, Western Governors University happens to be a really good actor. I trust the assessments when you say someone has mastered it. But if I really wanted to pin an entire system around this, I would want the assessments that Western Governors University has developed to effectively be an independent entity that could certify mastery of any set of fields, right? And any university could say, great. Any program of study could say, hey, great, we're going to help prepare you for mastery of these assessments. And Western Governors University, in my mind, has set the gold standard on what that looks like.
One of the big takeaways from our conversation together was the importance of empowering students that come from a wide range of backgrounds. Much of Michael's work at the Clayton Christensen Institute centers around disruptive innovation and how we can reach a wider pool of students to provide pathways to opportunity.
The reality I learned was that higher ed is sort of the dog wagging the tail, if you will, of K-12. And so if you don't actually fix what ails higher ed, the entire system cannot be changed, because the definition of a good high school is that which gets its kids into quote-unquote good colleges. And if the colleges are pointing at the wrong things, well, then the high schools are, then the middle schools are, then the elementary schools are. So you really have to focus on that higher ed to workforce intersection. So to answer your question, in higher education, the real disruptors have been new institutions that have come up. Western Governors University is the clearest cut example of a disruptive innovation in higher education. No holds barred. It's more affordable, more accessible, simpler to access, and it fundamentally redefined what performance and good looked like. That's what disruptive innovations do. They serve non-consumers, people who could not access the higher education that was there. That's what Western Governors University does, right? It serves adult learners who would never otherwise think about a four-year campus experience. So Western Governors University, in my mind, is the clearest cut example of a disruptive innovation that we have had in higher education. And if you look at the others that would fall under that, Southern New Hampshire University, but they didn't do it with their brick and mortar campus. Paul LeBlanc actually pulled Clay Christensen on his board, and together they set up an autonomous online university, completely free from the way business had always been done, so that it could reinvent itself. And it saved the university, dramatically lowered the price of a Southern New Hampshire University education. And as you know, Paul and Southern New Hampshire University have been really interested in trying to get into the path that Western Governors University blazed around competency-based, or what I like to actually call mastery-based education, where students, the focus is not the time spent, but on the learning itself.
And to cap off the season, we spoke with authors Dr. Adara Landry and Dr. Risa Lewis about their new book, Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact. In it, they break down how anyone can build workplace competencies by small, actionable steps.
A micro skill is a fundamental building block, a small, concrete step skill that is additive and translatable. And we believe micro skills together, added up, can help us achieve goals, projects, integrate habits, and basically accomplish all the big things that are overwhelming. It's a process of breaking things down into small pieces so we can get where we want to go in the workplace.
And I would add that some context to why we used the term micro skills. I think people have a lot of questions about why we use that word. And I think at the core of it, Risa and I are educators. We teach early career professionals, yes, in healthcare, in medicine, but the skills that we teach, the themes of teaching someone how to do something are translatable to, I think, any industry, whether it be law, education, consulting, et cetera. And one of the fundamental things that we have to do as physicians when we're teaching, let's say, a trainee how to do a procedure or how to care for a patient is that we teach the small steps to get to the end goal. So we would not tell a resident to go resuscitate a patient because that word resuscitate is a big, big, overwhelming task. And it's truly a series of very small, small skills, such as assess the patient, assemble a team, assign roles, time the interventions, and so forth. And all of these small things allow you to overall achieve your goal. So even though we have a medical background, we know that when it comes to training anyone in any environment, it's best to really break down those steps. And the reason why we want to do that is because it exposes the knowledge gaps. It allows people to see where they are stumbling and where their obstacles are. In addition, it allows you to track your progress in a much more digestible way so that you can really see how much you are learning and how much you are achieving. And that in itself can sometimes be motivation to continue.
The authors shared why they wrote the book and why this handbook was designed to reach historically underserved groups.
When people say, why did you write this book? Quite simply, we wrote the book that we wish we had been given when we were starting out. Now, we've gotten there. We've both been successful in our careers. And also, gosh, it could have been easier. Gosh, it could have been more efficient. And there was this feeling for me, and I'll start as early as like high school into college, college into med school, that somehow people knew how to navigate the workplace in ways that I did not. And I didn't know, I'm like, how do they know how to do these things or who told them? And one of the motivators in writing the book and putting this content out is we want to share what we've learned so that people can actually have an easier time of it. And so the content can really help them. We start out in the book sharing three truths. One is this concept that time is currency. Time can only be spent. So we should be really careful how we spend our time, with whom we spend our time, etc. And Adara and I together have published articles in, for example, Harvard Business Review or Fast Company. And those are not medical journals, but certainly the articles that you can find there about leadership, about communication, about managing a team, those are universal. So we appreciated that the lessons we were learning in healthcare were applicable to other industries. And we started writing articles during COVID together about navigating the workplace. And Adara came to me. She said, Risa, I want to write a book. I'm like, that sounds great. She's like, do you want to write it with me? And I was like, wow, amazing. Yeah, let's do it. And longer of a conversation and thought that went into it. But the bottom line is we'd had a really good track record of writing. We had a really good track record of writing these articles. And we got really nice feedback from people like, wow, that was super helpful. Oh my gosh, I'm going to share this with all my mentees. And it just felt important that we do this, that we get this book out there and share what we had learned in a way that can be helpful to so many more people.
And that's a wrap on season two, Chris.
Well, Emma, that's all we have time for today. Sage Advice fans, we'll see you all next season.
Thanks for listening to WGU's Sage Advice podcast.
Sage Advice is brought to you by Western Governors University. To learn more about WGU and how it's pioneering a new path in higher education, visit wgu.edu. If you enjoyed our discussion today, don't forget to subscribe to Sage Advice wherever you get your podcasts. Join us next time for more insightful conversations. Until then, keep learning, keep growing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what education can achieve. From the team here at WGU, thank you for listening to Sage Advice.